It's just past 18 hours, 31 minutes and 24 seconds, East African time. Time for John Sibi Okumu on Wednesday. This being Wednesday, the 10th of May, 2023. Hamjambo na karibuni, hello and welcome. In this edition, let me confess to being in what they call a comfort zone, because as an actor, director, and playwright myself, we are going to be discussing a topic very close to my own heart, namely the theatre in Kenya since our independence in 1963. Now, you may or may not know that the Kenya National Theatre, the iconic symbol of theatrical activity in the country, was founded in 1952 by the British colonial government. My guest, always a mystery to begin with, would be a prime contender to take on a commission to write a history of the theatre in Kenya. In that eventuality, he could do the research to list every single production in every single public theatre space since 1963. But beyond that, which other areas might be worthy of address? In the age-old formulation, we'll see. But first, let's hear some sample answers to the question, do you go to watch plays? Je, huwa unatazama michezo ya kuigiza?
Definitely is a waste of time, basically.
Jua giza, hiyo place uko na giza, inakuanga tu traumatizing sana jua hiyo darkness.
Growing up, I've been a drama person since I was a kid. I've been taking part in drama from primary school.
No, not really. Because mi kenye najua ni uko kwa theaters mwenanga wawili wawili.
These days, to watch anything has been reduced to social media. You can watch things over the phone. You don't have to physically go to the theater.
People prefer to bring the theater to their homes. But for me, I love to experience it firsthand. Actually, I love ballet too. That means I love to be in touch with the piece of art, wherever they are, whenever they present it. I love to watch it live.
Msanii mwenzangu, what do those remarks say to you?
Quite interesting, actually. The first one, that it's a waste of time, basically. Oh, no. It's not a waste of time. It's an industry. The other person talks about juu ya giza inakuwa traumatizing sana. This sounds like somebody who is afraid of the dark. Actually, a play cannot be done with lights on, so we have to put off the lights. The third respondent, giving up drama, grew up as a drama person, which is true, because in all schools, we have the school drama festivals running on from primary school to secondary school. And most students grow up with drama in their system and in their schools. As for Wawili, people go to the theater two by two. It sounds like Noah's Ark, but well, it's always nice to go with somebody to go and watch theater. In the other hand, social media, you don't have to physically go to the theater. Of course, you have to go physically to the theater, because the physical space is what you need in order to experience theater firsthand, to watch it live. As far as people bringing theater to their homes is concerned, surely, let's all go to the theater. Let's inspire cultural connections. To end the theater. Thank you.
Well, there are several things that are raised to me in that questioning. First of all, the idea of if you're perhaps inviting somebody to go to the theater, that the cost of taking somebody along with you is prohibitive. So the idea that most of culture is expensive, do you think it ought to be so?
Well, putting up a production is not an easy task. You need about 90 hours spread over 2 hours a day in order to mount a production. Productions are expensive. That's one of the reasons that it's also an expensive exercise. And if you have to do it in a way that you have to make to be able to make profit and maintain the pace of productions, then you have to charge, because most of this theater is not sponsored.
Again, I'm sort of hearing that this is the kind of activity that has been surpassed by other modes of entertainment. There's YouTube to contend with, there's a series of Netflix. What is to you, Msani, the particular allure of the theater? Why do you think it should be separated from other modes of entertainment?
YouTube, you can be able to rewind. Netflix, you can be able to rewind. But a live performance, never ever. You have to experience it firsthand. That's the joy of watching live theater.
Right. Okay, what else was being said? Well, there are people who actually were, you know, there were converts to the, and you spoke of a history. I want you to say something about the Kenya Schools Drama Festival, because to my mind, and perhaps everybody doesn't know that, the Kenya Schools Drama Festival holds something of a record worldwide in having run as long as it has. Could you say more?
The idea of the school drama festival actually was mooted in around 1952, actually, when the theater opened. And when the theater opened, it was a question of, like, you would have a Shakespeare month where you would have schools, the so-called elite schools at that time, would be able to mount productions at the Kenya National Theatre as part of a competition in order to make Shakespeare plays thrive. But after that, after independence, it was taken over, and one of the instrumental people to have the Kenya National Theatre, the drama festival, was a man called Wasambo Were, who was an educationist. And from then on, schools drama festival have been going on every year around September.
Well, I'd like to, I do know that, but I would ask you as a practitioner whether you think that the formulaic, we're now going into the realms of history and we'll come back and go a bit further, but let's stay with the drama festival. This idea of having a formula where year in, year out, there is the ethnic dance category and somebody comes up with a Luya Shikuti, people who are Gikuyu speaking come up with a circumcision song, and it seems to me that we are holding our children in something of a rut because we're not allowing them to present what they wish to present.
I would say that there's a unity in diversity, and they should be able to do any plays in their mother tongue if it is a song, and it encourages cultural practices, and well, good cultural practices at that.
Well, we'll return to that, but it's a bit like the manner of our examination system, this idea that you can have a kid who's got 355 points and another kid who's got 354 points, and the understanding is that maybe my child is cleverer than yours. Do you really think, Msani, that if you have 1,000 schools competing for one category, that it's possible to choose the best play? Under what criterion? Are you saying that creativity is a competition?
Oh, what I would say is the whole idea of participating in a competition, you are already a winner. The whole idea of you have people, I mean, mounting up a production is not easy. You are encouraging people to have teamwork. Whether you win or lose, or become number one or number two or the last, the whole idea is you have that experience of teamwork. That is what should be encouraged.
I set you up, Msani, by saying that you could perhaps write a book on this subject. So I'd like you to take you on the terrain of history. So if we're doing 1963 to the present day, our 60 years of independence, could you take us first to major beats from the founding of the theatre in 1952 to independence, and then maybe we can sort of skip and jump and come to the present day?
Okay. Let's start with 1952. When you talk about 1952, the first play that was shown at the Kenya National Theatre was called The Dark Lady of Sonnets. This was a play written by George Bernard Shaw, actually a comedy, where in the play, the main actor, who is William Shakespeare, gets a chance meeting with Queen Elizabeth II and begs her to start a Kenya National Theatre dedicated to showing plays by Shakespeare. That is the essence of why the colonialists had the Kenya National Theatre, because it was a question of they wanted their culture to come out as the English. But then things changed later. The turning point was in 1967. In 1967, there was a movie that had been commissioned by the Kenyan government. It was called The Kenya We Want. It was celebrating 5 years of independence. And it was shown, it premiered at the Kenya National Theatre. The then minister, who was a Tom Mboya at that time, saw the premiere and asked aloud, why, after 5 years of independence, why do we still have this place, the Kenya National Theatre, being run by Europeans instead of an African? That was the start of Africanization. So in 1968, an advert was put up where they asked for the first African director, and Seth Adagala was picked up.
Seth Adagala, indeed. Dear departed Seth Adagala. So we have but you're raising here this idea, for want of a better word, of racism, because you haven't quite got to 1973 when I made my first appearance on the National Theatre stage. But we had amateur theatre groups like the City Players, the Theatre Group, and the idea was that in order to move forward, we had to erase the colonial past. And I have a very vivid memory of the walls of the National Theatre at the time were sort of embroidered and embellished with signatures of various luminaries from the English stage, like Sir Ralph Richardson. And one of the acts of courage to erase was to go in there with some black paint, let's not name names, and deface all these signatures so that they were forever erased. So we get back to this idea of, you know, pulling down the statue because of what it represents. What are your views on that? Because if you erase something, what do you put in its place?
I would probably disagree with you on that point, because Nairobi City Players still continued as a big theater group even after the theater manager became African. Actually, they were the ones with the most shows at the Kenya National Theater. The point is, what I'm trying to say is the Africanization of the Kenya National Theater was spearheaded by Seth Adagala. Seth Adagala in 1970. In 1968 is when he came into, when he was made the African director. He formed the National Theatre Group, the National Theatre Drama School. The National Theatre Drama School was there for 1 year, and in 1970 they graduated. And when they graduated, they had their first practicals, which they had a play at Ukumbi Mdogo, the small theatre, which was a play by Ngugi wa Thiong'o, The Black Hermit, and the other one was Sons and Daughters by Joe De Graft. That was their first breakthrough as Nairobi, the National Theatre Company.
Right, we have to make the first of our stops. Thank you very much. Msani Mwenzangu, Twendelea. We were dealing obliquely with the topic of tension. And again, one of the things that I remember in a production of Romeo and Juliet, 1973. To give some indication of my age, I was in the last years of teenagerhood, and that was what they called a black and white production, perhaps the very first time in the world, maybe, that the play would have been done with the Capulets predominantly white and the Montagues predominantly black. And there was something of a frisson of saying that to continue highlighting Shakespeare, the likes of me belong to the camp of sellouts. So do you think in doing Romeo, I'm a sellout? Unfair question, but you're at liberty to answer it.
Okay, I never watched the production, but I see nothing wrong because, like I said,
but it was representative of a feeling, and I'm going as we go forward, Msani, we're going to, what's the American thing? We're going to unpack this and see how far we have dispelled these forms of prejudice and self-censorship. But at the time, it was a growing concern. This whole idea of the key word, maybe you're relatively younger than I am. Things had to be relevant, and if a play wasn't relevant, it was by definition to be excoriated.
I'm hoping that the play was by Nairobi City Players, not so.
The theatre group. Of the two major ones.
Okay. Because I would remember that in 1970, the first time when the theatre company, the National Theatre Company, collaborated with Nairobi City Players, they were able to have a play called The Lion and the Jewel being staged at the National Theatre stage. That was the first time. And it was a cooperation between Margaret Epsom, was in charge of costumes.
Mary Epson,
yes. Yeah. And James Falkland was doing the lights.
Right.
Yeah, so it was like a learning process, right, where now they were able to come on the main stage,
right,
with a bit of help from the, right, Nairobi City Players. So that collaboration in itself was what maybe culminated in you doing Romeo and Juliet. And I don't know whether it was before or after that, there was also Genesis, which I think you're part of.
Indeed, and we had a lovely sort of commemorative stamp that was put out at the time. I don't know how many years we were then, maybe we were 10 years old, and there were a succession of stamps put out to celebrate the National Theatre, Genesis being one of them. We're cross-referencing for those, our younger listeners, to look at, you've just mentioned the name James Falkland,
yes,
the great Dwyan of the Phoenix Players, yes, which rose from the ashes of the Donovan Mall Theatre. The Donovan Malls, the malls came here just after the Second World War, found a way of creating professional theatre, but importing their sort of core group from England and then sort of, you know, adding up to it with locals. I'd like you to evoke that Phoenix Players era, particularly the role that a name like James Falkland, what does it say or mean to you?
James Falkland came after Seth Adagala. That was 1982. Then after that, he was they started Africanizing the Kenya National Theatre by having managers appointed from the ministry, and that is how he went. He actually joined the Donovan Mall, then after that started his own repertoire company, the Phoenix Players, which was in existence. It was the first repertoire theatre in Kenya for a long time before it collapsed.
Okay, and a lot of us, I guess myself included, of a certain generation of actors, we had our sort of training. If it wasn't for theatrical training, it was by virtue of productions in the Phoenix, at the Phoenix rather. But a sad fate became the Phoenix Players, because so many years later, it actually was shut down, and everything that was in there carted onto huge lorries to be dumped in Dandora because the auctioneers came to shut it down. And in this instance, again, we're going obliquely, government played no role in its preservation. So has government been the friend of theatre? Would you say so? Have they backed us up?
I wouldn't say so. The government has not been very friendly to theatre, especially after 1982. Most of the plays were being banned. Any play that was against, that used to be the time when if you needed a license to do a play, you had to go to Nyayo House.
Well, there was a censorship.
There was a censorship board, yes.
So could you evoke that as a sort of walking library? Evoke that period, because in order to see where we're going, we have to go and see where we've come from. Censorship.
Censorship after the coup in 1982. It was impossible to do any play anywhere. All gatherings were almost like banned. There was like, you would always look behind your back to see. I mean, you would fear what you're going to say at any one point. So all plays were actually, if you needed a license, you had to go to the PC's office at Nyayo House. Then you go and present the play. You go and give them the play. I remember losing my ID. I had to give them my ID because we were doing a play called The Play of Giants by Wole Soyinka. And then those were some of the problems that we were having at that time. A play like Muntu, which had been commissioned by All African
Conference of Churches,
was also banned. It was removed from the curriculum.
Well, there are lots of anecdotes that speak to that particular experience. I know that there was a time, and maybe younger listeners would find this very hard to believe, that if you put on a play where the title was, for example, An Enemy of the People, and it was Ibsen, so everybody would ask themselves, who is this enemy of the people? And it must be subversive by its very nature, therefore let it be banned. I remember very vividly doing, because the thing to do then was to speak to the Kenyan condition, which was perhaps a bit inimical of self-expression, by setting our plays in other parts of the world so that we would do Death and the Maiden, which was about torture in a Latin American country, but we would transpose it to hope that the audience would make the linkages with Kenya. So, again, we can't exhaust that book that you might write. What would you say are the gains that have been made in the realm of censorship? Are we a freer society, or are we still looking furtively behind our backs as creatives?
As creatives, I would think right now we are freer. I mean, after the repeal of Section 2A, I mean, it's like in the new constitution, we are freer to express ourselves. That is one thing. There were also ways of like circumventing that censorship, which we actually did at one point. There was a play which was called The Players, written by one Kibisu Kabatesi, who was at that time incarcerated because of the coup, and he wrote that play on toilet paper. But we had to invite the Vice Chancellor of Nairobi to come to Alliance Francaise. That time it was called the French Cultural Center, to open the play. And the government looked the other way, and the play was just about his experiences in prison. And somehow it never got the axe.
Yeah, but I'm saying, Mwenzangu, let me take it on another level. Yes. I mean, to each generation, its own particular form of censorship. Because as a playwright, I ask myself, now, with the current climate and let's call it religious fanaticism, if we may, whether I, as a playwright, could write a play that evokes alternative sexuality. Surely that would be hammered as much as it was in the era which you evoke, the 1980s. So in other words, we've given up one form of rejection and espoused another.
I think in this era of LGBTQ,
yes.
I mean, you didn't have a problem about talking about alternative
sexuality. I beg to differ with you.
But you'd have a problem with the church.
Right.
basically. Right. But right now, if you, for instance, what I'm looking forward to is during the school's drama festival, I'm sure they'll talk about fanaticism, because that's what is happening in the country right now. And this is a time when young playwrights emerge from the school's drama festival to talk about what's happening in the country.
Okay, but I would say to you again, Msani, are we recording? Are we archiving? Could you walk into a bookshop anywhere in Nairobi? Tourists ask me this, and go to a section which says Kenyan theater, Kenyan poetry, and find more than 100 poetry books and 100 collections of plays. I don't think so, which is a savage indictment of progress made.
I would actually, I agree with you, because even at the university level, even at the university bookshop, you would not get some of these books. The other time,
But also, are they being written? Because I mean, we've Africanized. I've been listening to you carefully. Mm. We've Africanized. Tumeenda njia yetu, lakini tumeandika nini? Nieleze tumeandika ni gani? Mchezo wa kuigiza ambao tumeandika.
I think the problem right now is like there is a literary desert when it comes to playwrights. There are very few and far in between, and some of them are not even being published. But for instance, if we can be able to get that reserve, that is the school's drama festival. There are a lot of plays that have been done. Like, you can have 1,000 performances. All those things are scripted. Once they are scripted, the only thing they don't get is they don't get to be published. But again, we don't archive some of those festivals, because the problem is it's only the winners who go to perform for the president instead of the president coming to the theater to watch the plays.
Right.
So it's important that the president or the powers that be come to the theater to watch the winning plays.
Okay.
Maybe that way,
yes.
The girl who was saying that that is a waste of time, basically, can be able to see that theater is thriving in this country. It's important that we should watch plays.
Well, maybe that could be a time for our second break. Asante sana. Sanim Wenzangu, maybe this is the time for us to sort of go down memory lane and evoke highs and lows. And I will tell you that there was more cross-pollination at the time, because I remember as a young student going to see a production by the Ugandan playwright Renga Moy, Robert Serumaga, Renga Moy, and just being totally fascinated by this story, which was a tacit criticism of the Idi Amin era. And just about the time when, Saramago was in today's parlance, he was thereafter neutralized, I think is the term we use.
Yes.
But there were periods where there were productions which were seminal to the growth of our theater coming from within. What do you remember as you wish the young listeners would have been there to see them? You've already mentioned Muntu by Joe de Graft, which was an evocation of the history of Africa from a sort of Adam and Eve type story. Muntu, the father of all mankind, and the sons and daughters of Muntu sort of going up into different... The first son of Muntu representing tradition, whom I played in the inaugural production. He sort of bumped off by his younger brother, the second brother, who's gone to sort of the moral equivalent of Sandhurst, again played by the immortal Francis Mbuga. Then we had one of the sons of Muntu who becomes a priest, and that was played by the immortal and unforgettable Abel Ndumbu. So people from that era, if we're going to name names, Edwin,
Divine Drama.
Exactly. Yeah. David Mulwa.
Yes, exactly.
So what else have we got to be proud of?
Maybe the highlight would be 1977 when there was the FESTAC, the festival which was in Lagos, and we had two plays that we presented in Lagos, Nigeria. That was The Betrayal in the City by Francis Imbuga, and the other one was The Trial of Dedan Kemathi by
Ngugi wa Thiong'o.
Ngugi wa Thiong'o and Michelle Mugo. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was iconic.
Okay, so we've gone from a period. Have we got to a point? We also had, in the Moi era, we had people like Wahome Mutahi being very critical of government, but doing so in their own language. So in other words, you had the birth of something which could be called, for want of a better word, Kikuyu theatre. And imitative of that, we've had theatre in the Luo. Recently, there's a sort of Luya entrant into the game with a play called Esiekenye, Naked. I ask you as a citizen, whether with devolved government, with counties, are we headed to nations within a nation? And is the theatre actually going to be an instrument of division?
On the contrary, like I said before, there is unity in diversity.
That formulation. Because it's so sweet sounding to say that there's unity in diversity, but in most major civilizations, if you will, if you go to France, 90% of the people consider themselves to be French. One language unifies them. If you go to England, okay, people will argue that they're Irish and Scottish, but these are sort of being taught in little enclaves until, you know, people are harking back to them and make sure that they... But there is one driving national language. And you're saying to me, let Kikuyu theatre thrive, let the Luo... It's a contradiction in terms. I beg to differ.
I would say this. I was part of Wahome Mutahi's Giza production. And there was a play called Mogadhe Mufogodhi, and it was translated in Mtukufu Fimbo. When it was done in Swahili, very few people came to watch the play. So it's a question of numbers. If you do something in your mother tongue, I mean, people love to see their cultural dances. And if the message is put in your own mother tongue, you understand it better.
Would you travel to the USA and go specifically to an Italian theater and see a play played in Italian? When did they become independent? 1774, whatever. Would you see a Polish thing? Would you see, because Biden is meant to be Scottish, and I don't know, Clinton and all these people are meant to be Irish. I've never heard them evoke their Irish Scottish roots. They go back to visit and they look at the lake and they say, isn't it beautiful? But I think that the idea of language and the mode of communication is not going to go away.
I have enjoyed watching Luo plays
without
a translator.
Without a translator.
Yes.
I have enjoyed being in a Swedish town, city, Gothenburg, and saying, I love the theatre, and I dashed off to see a play which turned out to be A Doll's House. Again, Ibsen. But I didn't understand a word. So please, 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 we cannot sustain this argument if it's just nice to follow along. Because great art and great literature also carries language at its best, at its most subtle, at its most nuanced. That's why we have a certain attachment to Shakespeare's sonnets, or, you know, the language which he uses in King Lear. The story is pretty straightforward. You know, old man divides his kingdom amongst three daughters. But the language which he uses is of the essence. So are we all going to choose one language to master in order to write classics for the whole nation? Or are we going to do another 100 years of having 42 participants in the creative struggle?
What I would ask is, what would be wrong with translations? Maybe that's where we should come from. Because right now, we even have the national anthem, our own national anthem, being sung in all manner of languages. Doesn't have to be sung in Swahili per se or in English. I've gone to plays where, in Kikuyu plays, where the national anthem is in Kikuyu Oh, Luya plays where the national anthem, and Duo plays where the national anthem is sung in Luo. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. The play like Duani Ruok, Three Suitors, One Husband, Duani Ruok in Luo was so well translated that I enjoyed the play. I would understand in terms of, because it's performance. Once you understand the performance, you know what's going on. And
Msanii Mwenzangu,
yes, yeah,
we're already saying, and you've said, that there's a great difficulty in publishing. We've just said we could walk into a bookshop and there isn't a rack which is dedicated entirely. So you're saying, with the resources that we have, we are going to allow a playwright to write a play in El Molo. It's going to play with great success to all 1,000 El Molo everywhere. And then we're going to translate it for the national palate into English or Kiswahili.
If that's possible.
Because I'm talking about legislation. I think that in the history of the world, certain problems are solved by legislation. When I was at school as a student of French, I was told that Napoleon Bonaparte actually sort of took the French and gonged their heads together. You know, there were some of them who came from Brittany, les Bretons. There were the others who came from Languedoc. And he said, look, folks, this is the French language, which is going to be used by all. And it's the same with the translation of the English dictionary, which also standardized English language. So if you're saying that we're moving to a Kenglish, a Kenyan version of English with the admixtures of Sheng, then I'm with you. But to say that, you know, my people, the illustrious and lofty Avanyalov, whatever, you know, they're only, no, please. I do delight in my mother tongue, and I happen to be able to speak it because it was the very first language which I spoke. But I'd be deluding myself if I said that was the point of departure that was going to make me a national playwright. And maybe, you know, time, maybe we've, you know, we're going on a bit on this topic, but I do feel so passionately about it that I'll ask you something else after this, but say something on what I've just said.
Okay, if I might, I look at, for instance, the Bomas of Kenya. When you go there, you look at the melting point of all cultures, and then you have all the dances within the 42 tribes. That, for me, is a pointer of where we are and who we are. You cannot, for instance, have a Luya dance being sung in Swahili. It won't sound the same. You get what I mean? And the national, the Bomas of Kenya is a melting point of all cultures. So I would not see any reason why. And really, is that's my point of departure with you, because I think and I feel like we should still maintain our own identity.
Right. Well, I promise to leave it there. Our listeners can come in and have a conversation till midnight about it. Then we'd have succeeded. I'd like to have you comment. Let me try and sort of warn you of the topics that remain to us.
Yes.
This idea of the evocation of the creative industry, the idea that we can all make our millions and drive around with Nollywood and Bollywood and make lots of money. But before that, I would like to draw you on this idea of we have a ministry. Always, culture is always lumped with something else.
Sports
culture and youth, whatever, gardening and culture, youth, shot putting and culture. So in essence, we don't see the value in terms of government and governance as essential to the soul of a nation.
Partly.
And any minister who's given that role, which primarily should be a source of great pride to lead the whole nation in establishing its own set of values, thinks of it as a form of demotion, factory rejectism. Why not make me minister for finance? Why not make me minister for foreign affairs? Oh my goodness, I'm the minister for sports, culture, and gender.
Yeah, I think partly the problem is with the government itself, because
we've had several. Remember, we're looking at 60 years.
Yeah,
who's got it right, if anybody?
No one got it right, because we don't have a cultural policy. That's the most important thing. If you don't have a cultural policy, then everything to do with culture is a secondary thing.
So you're agreeing with me obliquely, because a cultural policy is a fancy word for legislation. Here was I 3 minutes ago pumping for legislation. You said, no, it's all very fine. Let everybody have their place in the sun. Now you're saying for policy, which means guidance, which means direction, which means legislation.
Yes, that's what I mean.
I think you're having your cake and eat it, as we say, as we say in England. Okay. Okay. Comment, please.
That lack of cultural policy is what makes the Ministry of Culture be lumped up with sports, because sports brings money. That's what they think. They don't see theater as productive as such. They don't look at it as creative enough. It does have employment. It generates employment, yes, but does it bring in the taxes that they want, that the government wants? You get what I mean?
I'll give you an image. Yeah. I was at the this year's Kenya Theatre Awards.
Yes.
And our Minister for Culture, among other things, the Honourable Ababu Namwamba, suddenly in his speech said that everybody who'd won an award on that particular night would be the recipient of 100,000 shillings. And I said, oh, goodness gracious me, I won an award the year before. If only I'd saved it for this year, I'd have 100,000 shillings in my pocket. But the thing is, the government or a government representative gave artists as an incentive, gave them money. But in the report about the Kenya Theatre in the past year, they said that as part of the creative economy, it had raised 30 million shillings. Now, 30 million shillings for me isn't a fortune. So you see why I'm just saying, you know, pay them off. Kila mtu ambaye alishinda mpatie shilingi 1,100.
But I'm afraid to say that even when they say that they had 30 million, that's what they raised. It's money raised from booking of the Kenya National Theatre. That's what I think. Because the Kenya National Theatre has now become like a big booking office. People book for space. The management does not have a single, they don't have a calendar where they do productions that are from that are Kenya National Theatre driven. They don't sponsor productions. They don't have their own productions. They don't have directors. People who come to hire the theatre are private individuals. That's where we go wrong, and that's why we need that cultural policy.
Right, and time for our final break. I'm Sanim Wenzangu. It is 19 hours, 15 minutes, and just past 42 seconds. Time for our last segment. And I want to evoke two things in the time that remains to us. And this whole idea, let's stay with it for a bit longer, the idea of the creative economy, the idea that the arts, the artist, the actor, the stage manager, the makeup artist is actually going to make a living out of this. Now, let's go back to my Phoenix Players days, where Uncle James, as in James Falkland, will give us 100 shillings for each performance played. And I think we did like 13 of them. Going to rehearsals, we had to be there out of our own finances because we loved the theatre so. But we made 1,300 bob. Now, any actor, I believe, who wants to go on the stage wants to have so many thousand shillings per production. Is this desire for people to be paid without actually having gone to school to learn their craft, who just say, I've got a nice voice, I'm good looking, or I'm evil looking, or whatever makes me stand out from the crowd, this is my calling card to make a living. I'm an actor.
Yeah, okay. Actors should get paid because the cost of living has gone up, and if they practice the craft, it's for the producer to be able to market the show well and pay them. Now, the thing is, there's a difference between amateur theatre and professional theatre. I would think in terms of professional theater, in African professional theater, the person who actually like started it was Sarakasi Players. Sarakasi Players was run by one, actually an accountant by the name of Weru Munyoro. And what he did was to make contracts with the actors. He looked for professionals in the trade, people who have done a lot in terms of theater. He looked at people.
So professionalism was past experience rather than training. They hadn't gone to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, RADA. They hadn't gone to...
What I would say is, like, I'm referring to two professional actors. I'm referring to Paul Onsongo and Anne Wanjugu.
Yes.
These are people who are trained. Trained, in fact, they were the first, some of the first graduates of the...
National Theatre School.
Of which I spoke in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And for them, and you see what he was looking at is like stars who can have a following. And he was able to have these plays done outside the traditional confines of the theater. He would take them to bars. He would take them all around the country so that a play would have a running time of like 1 year every weekend. The other person who did the same thing was Wahome Mutahi, Igiza Productions. Again, those productions...
Wahome Mutahi being for us and the great masses, he was Whispers.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
The column Whispers, the dear departed Wahome Mutahi. Yeah. Do continue, sorry.
Yeah, so yeah. Igiza Productions was able, like, for instance, there are plays like Sheigana ni Sheigana, I mean, Enough is Enough. There were plays like Jomo Kenyatta, The Man, that was actually like, it ran for 2 years. Every weekend, it would go to different parts of the country. And those actors were contracted to be paid so much within every performance. So they would get money every weekend. What we don't have really right now is, even when you talked about the great James Falkland, the repertoire theater, you're talking about a 2 weeks performance. In other countries, you'd have a 6 year run of the same thing. That is how you get professionals. That is how people earn from theater. It's the long term, a play that can like run for, like Cut People, for instance. It ran for 6 years. Somebody like Yul Brynner is remembered, for The King and I, the play. Not as Moses in Ten Commandments. He's remembered for his performance of The King and I, which ran for many years. So that's what we are talking about. Professionally, any producer should look at, let's have a run at the Kenya National Theatre for like 1 year. That is what now makes professional, because you are earning from that. But if you are going to do performances for a weekend or a single day, you cannot make money out of that kind of performance.
We've got about 5 minutes to Museni Mwenzangu, to 5 minutes, not a long time, before you reveal yourself, to deal with this idea. We've taken the National Theatre as the iconic symbol and representative of the country at large.
Yes.
But the country is big, in kiddie speak. What do you think has happened over the last 60 years in expanding theatrical activity so that it's part of the diet of the whole nation? And with the idea of, again, devolved government, county government, we've been promised social halls, stadia by various governments, and at the end of 10 years, there aren't any. Well, I exaggerate to prove a point. Maybe there are some. But we're doomed. We're doomed.
Yeah, almost, yes. We are doomed, yes.
Because, oh, my gosh, don't make it so short. I thought you'd come back.
Of the problems that we've been having is most of these social halls, the social halls that were in the estates have been turned to churches. Most film theaters have all been turned into evangelical buildings. I mean, that's where all the bishops go and whatever. I mean, look at Nairobi, for instance. A place like the Royal Theatre, Cameo, right now, now it's Cameo.
Yes, indeed.
Which was a film hall. Again, on Sundays, it becomes a church. Odeon Cinema, again, is a church. Liberty Cinema has become a church.
So is that a condemnation or a statement of fact?
It's a statement of fact. The social halls have become churches, but rather than a place where theatre can be able to reach the people.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So there's no... Actually, we are having very little... in terms of theater spaces are becoming fewer and fewer. That's the problem. The only people who have seemed to expand are actually the Indians, because they have built gigantic halls where they go and take their place, They are moved away from the Kenya National Theatre. And those plays are well attended. You're talking about 6,000 sitters here at the theatre, the only Kenya National Theatre that we have. I mean, you have reduced that space to 380 seats. Seriously, if you are going to do a play and you are expecting 380 people to come and you are being charged for the theatre, hire of the theatre at 50,000 and 2,000 per hour for rehearsals, surely how much are you going to charge people in order to get even? That's the problem that we have. But like I said, if the theatre can be able to mount its own production, because they won't have any overhead cost in terms of paying for rehearsal space and things like that, they should be their own producers. That's what I mean.
One last question.
Yes.
Do you think that 60 years on, the idea without any call to quality, that the Kenya National Theatre, is that title in itself is too heavy a burden for every tourist to come here and say, that is the best because it's at the Kenya National Theatre? Would you call for a name change and call it the Harithuku Theatre, or call it the Nairobi River Theatre, instead of giving it this baggage of being the National Theatre? What do you as an artist think about that?
I think it was Ngugi wa Thiong'o who actually said that it's just an edifice. It's a colonial edifice which is neither Kenya nor national, no, a theatre.
So should we change its name? It could be a solution.
No, changing its name doesn't matter. Changing its name.
Yes.
You see, as long as, like I said, my thrust is, as long as the Kenya National Theatre continues to churn its own plays, it continues to have its own calendar and determine its own calendar, then that is the only way forward. We have little theatres. We have Mombasa Little Theatre. We have Nairobi, Nakuru Players, Nakuru Players Theatre.
Kisumu, we've got
Bat
Masira.
Yeah,
and
but you see, they don't have a calendar, because this is something that you should be selling to tourists when they are coming in, on KQ, on any airline, the performances that are supposed to be at the theatre. That's what most opera houses do. We don't have that.
Mystery over. May I ask, who are you?
My name is Stini Njoroge. I'm a theatre actor and director.
Stini Njoroge, theatre actor and director.
Yes.
Do you, to our audience, do you, at your age, regret having made that choice? And if you don't regret it, what has been the fulfillment and the satisfaction for you? Because I seem to think that it hasn't been monetary.
The satisfaction that I have is to live as an example. And if I've been able to nurture people who look at theatre as a way of life. And right now it's like theatre has already, the most actors are metamorphosed. They are now in film, they are in television, they are broadcasters. You see, that for me is important. That the current crop are the ones that we have left so that the industry can be able to thrive.
So do you have enough, 3 minutes perhaps, to evoke your journey, if it's representative? Because I was reading an autobiography about Musalia Mudavadi just before he ran for some high post in the past. And one of the people whom he remembered seeing as a young undergraduate and named by name was you. So, in the recent past, the last Jamhuri Day, no, the last Mashuja Day, you were actually named as a Shuja, as a national hero. How do you feel about that? Do you think it's something that you've worked for and it's actually happened and it's well deserved?
Yeah, I would think it would be well deserved, and I don't know who gave out my name, but the point is, I've been practicing theater as a product of the Kenya National Theater, of the Kenya Drama Festival. I was voted as the best actor in 1978.
In 1978?
Yes.
Okay.
For the Trials of Brother Jero. I was playing Brother Jero.
Okay, forget the hubris, forget not being humble and all that.
Yes.
Is it not true that people have to look at you in another light now because you're also to be seen now in films and on television? Could you talk about that? Because now you're a screen actor as well.
What I would say is, in our time, when I joined the university, for instance, in 1979, I was under the pupillage of, he was my mentor actually, John Luganda was my mentor, David Rubadiri. Nairobi University Players, when it was, I was very active in Nairobi University Players. And that was the period when there was the free traveling theater and would be able to tour the country as showing plays outside the university. And this was a project that had been mooted. It was stolen from the Makerere University, where Uganda was, and he exported that idea here, and it was taken over by the Nairobi University. But right now, the project of free traveling theater is almost dead. Nobody has taken it over. People are not interested anymore. Education theater too was the place to be. It was the place where we were watching plays. It was an alternative space for showcasing talent. Even that space was taken over. Now it's become, that's where the students gather for lessons and things like that. So you see, we've been trying to kill spaces.
So I'm registering in this sort of contemplative navel gazing of Kenya at 60. As far as the theater is concerned, I note nostalgia, lament, depression, correct?
I wouldn't say that I'm depressed. But what I would say is like, it's really like once you're in the theater, the next step is actually a progression. You join film, you go to TV. That's where probably the money is instead of theater. But people, even when they go on film and whatever, they should go back and put in something into the theater. Like you, Mwalimu, for instance. You have been a theater practitioner. You went into radio, you went into TV, you went to film, but you still put back something for the theater as a playwright. That, for me, is an important thing to do.
I wouldn't disagree with that, but it's 19 hours, 30 minutes, and just past 18 seconds, and it's time for us to stop. Do continue to give us feedback, hopefully positive and reassuring, on the Twitter handle at Capital FM Kenya, or drop us a text or WhatsApp message on 0701-984-984. I've been talking to stage and theatre actor Steeny Njoroge, named a national hero on last year's Mashujaa Day. And guess what? You've been listening to John Sibiokumu on Wednesday. Thank you, as ever, most graciously for doing that. Much obliged. Until next time.